humans. Hello, hello, humans. Happy Thursday to you. This is deep-voiced Ellie Krug sitting in for Mike McEntee, who is on a well-deserved vacation. He will be out until next Wednesday, so you'll have me every day. Until then, this is day three of me subbing for Mike. And I've got to tell you, I sat out in the interior room listening to Matt Miller do his thing, and it was a sight to behold as he was making his face. I don't know if you caught it on Facebook Live. He is phenomenal. That would be the word that I would use, not only for his impressions but for his smoothness. And he is an incredibly difficult act to follow, let me just tell you. And so here I am trying to follow that act. Someone with 1/10 of the experience that he has. But here I am nonetheless. I've had a really, really great time the last couple of days trying to fill the shoes of Mike, who, those are incredibly big shoes, and now following Matt. There you go. So we have a number of different things that I'm keeping abreast of. You heard me yesterday talk about some things. I want to come back to a few things that, first of all, on stories that are both local and national, and I want to follow up on something that Mike had started before he left to go on vacation, and that was about the ongoing saga with Michelle Fischbach, who has now ascended. I think that I see that word everywhere that I read about her becoming lieutenant governor, that she's ascended as if it was some kind of a religious experience to the lieutenant governorship. Of course, that occurred when Governor Dayton appointed Tina Smith to fill the shoes of Al Franken. Now, Fischbach, before that, served as the Senate president for the GOP, and she had proclaimed at the time that she was appointed lieutenant governor that she wanted to remain with her Senate seat, which would also include her leadership role as the Senate president, and that she would hold both positions simultaneously. Of course, that raised a chorus of complaints from the DFL and Democrats, and you know, rightly so in a variety of ways. So today, though, to add to all of that, Michelle Fischbach announced that she would not accept the pay of the lieutenant governor. That's an $83,000 paycheck per year, but instead planned to keep her $65,000 salary as a Senate president. So she wants to hold both positions, but she's not going to take the pay for the lieutenant governorship. So apparently that means that she's not double dipping. Now, Senate Minority Leader Tom Bach and others have called for her to resign her Senate seat. They've cited a 1972 amendment to the Minnesota Constitution that essentially makes sure that there's a division between the lieutenant governor and the governor itself, and that this really means it is a separate position within the state government. And also, there is another constitutional provision that bars legislators from holding two elected offices. But Fischbach appears to be pretty adamant that she's going to hold both offices. I think all that we can say about this is that it's just going to end up with the lawyers. And I happen to be a lawyer, but no longer practicing. But, you know, lawyers help resolve a lot of controversies, sometimes not cheaply and sometimes not quickly. But thank God we have them when we need them. And so, all right, I've got some other stories I want to come back to, but I've got a call. I've got a writer on the line who's done a wonderful story about what it means to crowdfund for medical expenses. So Stephen Marsh is a writer with Mother Jones. He has authored a recent article called Go Fund Yourself. You can just Google that, Go Fund Yourself, which is about crowdsourcing, crowdfunding for people who have major medical needs. Stephen, are you on the line?
Yes, sorry, there were technical issues on my end. Sorry about that.
Don't worry about it. We're happy to have you, and we'll just we'll just make sure our interview continues with you even after our break. And so we'll just kind of break it up a little bit. How's that sound? All right.
Sure.
All right. So Stephen, you have done a very detailed journey through the crowdfunding world as it relates to people who are crowdfunding their medical expenses. Can you tell us a little bit about how this crowdfunding works? And just let us hear, what did you find?
Well, I think, you know, most people's experience of crowdfunding when they first hear about it, at least when I hear about it, is the success stories. So it's like J.J. Watt raising, I think it was $37 million last time I checked for Houston, or, you know, people going on Ellen DeGeneres and raising millions of dollars for cancer treatment or things like that. But, you know, it is a very new technology. And when you look closer, the research, you know, not necessarily my research, but the research of the health professionals is that somewhere around 90% of these campaigns aren't successful, fail to meet their goals. And they're also kind of an engine of inequality. They're done with the absolute best of intentions, but they nonetheless create more inequities in the American healthcare system, a system which did not need more inequities.
Well, let's set the groundwork a little bit further here. You are Canadian, and you have the benefit of a medical system, which, of course, down here in the U.S., we hear, oh, there are all these delays and waits up in Canada. It's not very efficient. But you and I have talked, and I know anecdotally from other Canadians, your system is pretty darn good.
Well, you know, like, I actually think the thing is not really that our system is so great. Like, Britain's system in many ways has better outcomes. Germany's system has many outcomes, has better outcomes than our system. It's really not that we're so good. It's that your system is so bad that it barely qualifies as a system at all.
Well, and I think that the perspective is, in Canada at least, medical care is looked at as kind of a human right. And here in the U.S., it's not so looked that way.
I would say that for every other Western democracy and advanced economy, medical care is treated as a human right. That would include the conservative parties of every other major advanced economy. You know, like, you're not going to find anyone in Japan arguing for privatizing medical care, for instance. So, you know, it is a uniquely American phenomenon.
Well, and yes, and so as you did your research, tell us, how does it work with crowdfunding? So there are some organizations that are actually dedicated to helping crowdfund for medical needs. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, GoFundMe and YouCaring are sort of the leaders in this field. YouCaring is almost entirely medical at this point. Like, it's by far the biggest category, and they sort of specialize in it. You know, crowdfunding is originally started to help people raise money to go on foreign missions, but it's since become a patchwork for the whole social safety net. I mean, I didn't really get into this in peace, but there are part of crowdfunding now is raising money for your maternity leave, right? So that you can take a couple of weeks off work after after you've had a baby. That too, in every other advanced economy, is treated simply as a right that every citizen would have. So, like, what's basically happening is that these crowdfunding sites are going where the social safety net in America is breaking down. And they openly admit, or at least the people I talk to at YouCaring, that they're nothing but a Band-Aid on a very broken system.
Right. And so it really essentially works that if you get sick, you can go to YouCaring, and that is YouCaring, correct?
Yeah. And yeah, YouCaring.com.
And you can create a profile, set a goal for how much money to raise for you to help deal with your illness, and then you know, hit a button and there you go. Is that about, I mean, I know
that's
very simplistic, but, and what did you find in your research? Now, you talked a few minutes ago about inequity and equality and how that this exacerbates that. So can you explain that? And in a second, we're going to have to take a break, but we'll have you come back and talk more about that. But go ahead and get started at least.
Well, I mean, I would say that the obvious things are that what leads people to raise, you know, people think like they'll post this and then they'll just go viral and they'll be on Ellen DeGeneres and all their problems will go away. But, you know, like, first of all, you need a definite level of media savvy and digital marketing skill, which is, you know, not that common. You also, like, it definitely, the richer your social networks, the more money your friends have, the more likely you are to get money. And also, like, the more friends you have, the more popular you are, the more likely you are to succeed in your goal. So these are all, like, basically this is healthcare for popular people with rich friends who, and also who have, like, appropriate illnesses, like illnesses that are not socially unacceptable. Like, you're not allowed to raise money for an abortion on GoFundMe. It's you know, stigmatized diseases are not very common. And so basically, you know, the basic facts of the machinery of this lead to more inequality.
Okay. And when, so we're going to have to take a break, Stephen, but when we come back, I want to talk more about this inequality and also about how this is about connecting people, that what you found is that it is a vehicle to get help people get connected. We've been talking with Stephen Marsh, a writer with Mother Jones, about his Go Fund Yourself article. When we come back from our break, we'll talk a little bit more with Stephen. Thanks so very much.
The fine folks at Common Good Books will help you find the perfect book for you or the book lover in your life. Find a huge selection from a locally owned and independent bookseller in the Twin Cities. They are always bringing in top authors from around the globe for special in-store events. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Find Common Good Books at 38 South Snelling Avenue in St. Paul or shop online at commongoodbooks.com.
This is Ken Hagland of Minnesota Hospice, inviting you to listen to our brand new show airing on AM 950 on Saturdays from noon to 1. The Minnesota Hospice Show looks forward to discussing how we honor life and to exploring the physical, spiritual, mental, and emotional issues we experience throughout all stages of life. Learn how hospice is the new face of hope and how it's your benefit, your choice. Join us Saturdays at noon and check us out online at minnesotahospice.com.
Congratulations, you survived the holidays. Now what about cleaning up that holiday mess? Fortunately, right now is the best time of the year to call Zero Res and let their professionals do their empowered water thing. Why? Because Zero Res is having a holiday hangover sale. This month you can get 3-room Zero Res clean starting at only $119. Plus this month you can still get a great deal when you get your air duct Zero Res clean. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMN.com. Zero Res, spell it backward or forward, it spells the same.
Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin, wherever you are and however you like it, we're just the place you're looking for. 6 unique, fun, exciting, winning destinations located throughout central Wisconsin. Make your rounds to Wittenberg, Nakusa, Black River Falls, Toma, Madison, or Wisconsin Dells for the hottest slots, most exciting games, award-winning guest service, delicious food and spirits, lodging, and live entertainment. Join the Ho-Chunk Gaming Rewards Club for free. And with a single card, you can earn valuable points no matter which of the 6 locations you choose to play. That means more exclusive offers, giveaways, cash back, discounts, and much more. Visit us online to see all we have to offer and find the fun times nearest you at HoChunkGaming.com. So wherever you are and however you like it, we're just the place you're looking for. Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin, Wittenberg, Nakusa, Black River Falls, Toma, Madison, and Wisconsin Dells.
Experience the difference. Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin.
Must be 21 or over to play.
And we're back. My bumper music is a banjo? I didn't know that. Okay. Hi. Hello, everyone. This is Ellie Krug. You've been listening to. I've been guest hosting for Mike McEntee, who is on a well-deserved vacation. You've had me so far this week, and you'll have me for the rest of the week and part of next. We have been speaking with Stephen Marsh, who is a writer with Mother Jones Magazine, about crowdsourcing for medical needs. Stephen, before we broke, you started to talk about some of the attributes of a successful crowdfunder for medical needs, and you were really writing. I'm drawing a picture of somebody who was coming to mind for me, somebody who probably was of majority race, fairly well educated, and somebody who was connected. You know, who had access to people who had money. I mean, did your research bear that out?
No, part of the problem here is that these are, these are privately held companies, so they don't have to release any data at all, and they certainly wouldn't release that data to me. So I was dealing with researchers, external researchers in universities who've done their own surveys, which are naturally much less sophisticated than the data that the sites themselves have. But I would say that for example, we don't know about race. However, if you go through if you want to see a bunch of pages that aren't successful, like look up sickle cell anemia, because it's possibly that, but it's more like chronic diseases don't do nearly as well. Right. What people want is the hit of giving to change people's lives. And that is very much what you have to market. So just as in marketing, any charity, you never market, we're going to save a dog pound. What you say is we need $100,000 to save a dog pound. What you say is we need $1,000 to save this dog's life today. And that's how you get money, right? So the successful campaigns tend to be people with diseases that can be cured and that these people can go back to normal life. Now, that's just not a lot. That's just not all diseases, right? That's actually a very specific subset of diseases.
So Crohn's disease isn't getting a whole lot of traction.
Pardon me? Which disease?
Crohn's.
Crohn's disease. Yeah. I don't know. I only did the ones that I look at, and I want to be really specific and detailed because the research is at times a bit vague, and you want to be absolutely accurate about these things. In general, chronic conditions tend to do less well than immediate conditions, according to the experts.
Okay. And so now the other question I have for you is, because what your story does attribute is that there's been a decrease in contributions to charities generally, but an increase in the numbers of people giving and the amount of dollars going into these crowdfunding organizations. I have that right?
Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
All right.
I mean, that seems to be the pattern. I mean, there's a definite correlation. There's no proof that they're related, but it does seem to be that people are giving to their friends, and then when they give to their friends, they don't have any more money to give to other people, to larger charities, say. And so that's a very significant change just in society generally, really.
And the question I had for it is, when you and I talked in preparation, was also, though, did this reflect, a human desire to be connected to someone? If you're going to give money, if you're going to help a human, that you actually want to know where the money is going, and that you want to feel as if it's doing good. And it's a lot easier if you can see somebody on a screen, you know what their story is because they've told you it, and you have a better sense that your money is going to help them get better.
Right, of course. You want to give to your cousin who gets sick with cancer rather than cancer research. But, actually the money that goes to cancer research is pretty useful and helps to contribute to, vast improvements for whole groups of people. So, I mean, of course, it's human nature to give to your cousin rather than to cancer in general. And also, I think, a lot of these people, a lot of these people that I was talking to, they're not particularly wealthy. Their networks are not particularly wealthy. So when people give money to their cousin or their friend or from high school or whatever, you know, they don't have, that's their charity for the year used up. They don't have money to give to, you know, cancer research in general. So, you know, as we're all trying to patch up the cracks of, you know, collapsing American social safety net, you know, other things go by the wayside for sure.
Well, and the last thing I want to talk about is, you know, this goes back to really history in America, because originally we were reliant totally on charity for providing medical assistance for people who weren't very rich. And then Medicare and Medicaid came into place in the early 1960s. And that reduced, you know, we've all heard that phrase charity case, and that that shifted the way society worked from relying on charities to one where the government thankfully took on the task of caring for its citizens who have health needs. And then if you could bring us forward, what did Ronald Reagan do? I mean, say what you will, but what did he do?
I mean, you know, Eisenhower explicitly said at the passing of the Medicaid bill, like he said, you know, it is a fundamental indignity that any citizen would have to ask for charity for their medical needs. I mean, when I go for medical care here and I'm given it by the state, I don't regard that as charity. I regard that as the system in which I live and to which I contribute. But Reagan explicitly said, like, we want charity back in American life because that is a social benefit in and of itself. That is, it's good for people to give money to their fellow neighbors, and this creates a better, more caring society because people are charitably giving rather than having things taken from them in taxes. And this, to anyone who has lived in both of these systems like I have, is just total insanity. Because, like, you know, the Marissa Radar, like the woman I interviewed and who had stage 4 cancer and who was, like, you know, begging her social networks for charity, did not experience that as freedom or as a positive aspect of her social encounter. She experienced it as really embarrassing and horrifying and also, like, just tough. And so, you know, it is this kind of twisted rhetoric of freedom that that permits, like, it's so free that you have to beg for your life, and it just, you know, and it just is ultimately in some sense insane.
Well, and I think that many Americans would agree with you about the insanity part. We and of course what's happening now is a very determined effort, because President Obama's name is associated with an improvement to our healthcare system, that there's a very determined effort to pull and destroy everything that his name is associated with. So that means our, you know, what we have for a safety net for healthcare. Well, Stephen, I've really enjoyed talking with you. And
it's been a pleasure.
And if our listeners want to read more about your story, then go find it on Mother Jones. Is that correct?
Mother Jones, yes. The Mother Jones website will have it, motherjones.com.
All right. And you also have your own website. Is that right?
Yeah, stephenmarsh.com.
All right.
That one's probably harder to find, though, because my name's spelled funny, but...
Well, it's spelled M-A-R-C-H-E. I'll give you the plug. So, Stephen, thank you so thanks so very much. I really appreciate your time today. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for doing this research. Very, very important
my
and very enlightening. All right,
okay.
Take care. We've been speaking with Stephen Marsh, writer with Mother Jones, about his article, Go Fund Yourself, about how many in America are resorting to crowdfunding to help pay for their astronomical medical expenses. When we come back, I have another interview. How do you like that? In a minute. Thank you. Bye.
Hello, friends. I've been talking to you about Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens, Minnesota's first green cemetery dedicated to celebrating life and protecting our environment. One of the many wonderful things they have is something called the Living Urn. Ashes are buried in an urn with seedlings, ultimately coming back to life as a glorious tree. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Why don't you log on to the website, mngreengraves.com. Learn more about Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens. See if it might be something that's meaningful for you.
While shopping for a fireplace insert at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, I was amazed at all the choices. Not just gas, electric, or wood-burning, but also built-in or freestanding, and options in every style from antique to modern. The staff really listened to us, explained the options, and helped us choose a fireplace we absolutely love. Now it warms our hearts and our home every winter. Thank you, Woodland Stoves, for a great addition.
Hi, I'm Peter Solak, putting in a word for the EPA Burn Wise campaign. It has important information about clean burning fireplaces. This is an important part of our mission at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces. We know that the fireplace has to work. Work with your life, work with your living space, and also be environmentally smart. Come see us. Learn to burn wise. We have over 35 working units on display at the corner of Riverside and East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. Visit our store in person or online at woodlandstoves.com.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, out of the ordinary products and services since 1977.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
Hi, Matt McNeil for my favorite Toyota, the Sienna from Rudy Luther Toyota. It's the most amazing vehicle I've ever owned. It's so good, after a decade of driving one, I just bought my second one. Roomy, seats the entire family and their friends and the dog. The safety features, the entertainment system, the fuel economy. Siennas are fantastic vehicles. I will likely own a Sienna as long as I'm driving. See for yourself by test driving the ultimate family vehicle, the Sienna, at Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Hunter Haas. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around negative 11. Friday, sunny and cold with a high near 4. And Saturday, partly sunny with a high near 12. Eat Local Minnesota is a great way to find locally owned Minnesota restaurants featuring high quality food and unique eating experiences. Local food, microbrews, original dishes, vegetarian options, and much more. Some Eat Local Minnesota restaurants include Crooner's Lounge and Supper Club, Great Wall, and Seward Co-op.
We're back. No banjo that time. We've got something a little bit more sophisticated. You're listening to Ellie Krug. I'm hosting a guest host this week for Mike McEntee, who is on a well-deserved vacation. We just got done talking about how Americans need to crowdfund to pay for their medical costs because our government will not recognize medical care, basic medical care, as a human right. And that brings us over to another topic about human rights, and that is about the right to be in this country. As many of us are aware, we've heard of the DACA program. We've heard of how our dreamers, I think the last number I heard was 800,000 of our dreamers are at risk of not being able to be allowed to stay in our country, and about how the parents of our dreamers are being deported as we speak. And on the line, I have John Keller, the executive director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, to help us learn a little bit more about the current status of DACA. John, are you on the line?
I am. Good afternoon, Ellie.
Good afternoon, John. It's great to talk with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what DACA, some folks don't know what the DACA stands for. And can you give us an idea of where things presently are for our kids? I call them our kids because they are.
Yeah, thanks. It's a pleasure to be back on AM 950 and pleasure to work with you, Ellie, on this and many other issues in the past. DACA is a simple program, unfortunately caught up in the politics of immigration right now. President Obama created special protection from deportation and the ability to work back in June of 2012 for people who came to the United States as children. And the concept behind it was that the U.S. government had no interest in deporting these people who came to the U.S. as children, who grew up in the United States and that we were going to allow them to live and work without fear of deportation until Congress passed or passes a permanent protection for them. Unfortunately, what we know, what's been in the news really since the campaign, and most particularly since September of 2016, is President Trump's rescission of that very protection that Obama created in 2012, putting hundreds of thousands of folks with DACA at risk of losing status, of losing their ability to work, losing their ability to stay in college, and sometimes both.
And these are kids brought to the U.S. by their parents when these kids had no say. I mean, they're just children. And they've lived here in the United States for most or almost all of their lives. And do they know any other country other than the United States? I mean, what is this? Is this madness on my part, John? I mean, yeah. Is it just?
We think it's important anytime we talk about immigration to introduce, you know, basic facts to help people understand, because this is an area of law and politics, unfortunately, where people know very little, and there's a lot of misinformation intentionally traded on this issue. So when we step back, what do we know? What are some of the facts about people who have DACA? First, in the state of Minnesota, it's about 7,000 young people. As you mentioned earlier, in the United States, it's about 800,000 people. These are people who voluntarily sent in all of their basic biographic information to the U.S. government, who've gone through two and sometimes three different fingerprint and background check analyses. They've had clean records. So that's just the government process that they've gone through. The biographic data on them, we know that the average age that somebody who qualified for this program came to the United States was 6 years of age.
Oh, my God.
At Immigrant Law Center, our youngest client that we helped get DACA came at 2 months. So, you know, the question you asked is, do they know someplace else? Oftentimes, they have no memory. And those that came older, you know, they've grown up here. The average age of a dreamer with DACA today is 26 years of age. So their home, their experience, their key experiences, and most importantly, I would say their future and their family oftentimes is here. And the polling, this is another area where it's important to introduce information. Republicans, even Trump supporters, Democrats, independents, all support in the 60 to 80% range in polling, creating a permanent protection for these young people.
And John, where are things right now? I mean, the last I heard was that we needed to fund the wall in order for Congress to move forward with DACA. Is that where things presently are, or is it even worse than that?
It sort of depends. There's a lot of politicking and posturing going on right now. Unfortunately, President Trump, like on many issues, has been inconsistent on this one. He started out back in December of 2016, excuse me, and for several months, saying nothing but positive things about the Dreamers. We were encouraged. It was the one area where we were hopeful the president would help move the Republican majorities for a piece of legislation. And then, unfortunately, everything changed in September when the rescission was announced. The gradual, you know, loss of status come March of 2017, you know, we'll be having about 1,200 to 1,400 people losing their status every day.
You mean March of 2018?
2018, yeah, yes. Sorry. At this moment, you know, the Democratic leadership is saying that they're committed to making this one of their top priorities in terms of negotiations around extending the government shutdown or the government funding issues on January 19th. That's the first next kind of deadline for action.
Okay.
What we're hearing from the White House and from some Republicans is that, you know, they want to add all of these conditions before they'll agree to take up the DREAM Act. So they want to add you know, maybe taking away certain family petitions. They want to perhaps take away the ability for these young people to ever become U.S. citizens. They want to, you know, keep adding some of the laundry list of punitive immigration issues, which is not going to get us to a solution. The wall is included in those.
And here we are. There's one thing I want to really make sure the audience is aware of. We have 800,000 young people who sent to the government all kinds of personal information about them, including their address, including where they work, where they go to school, relatives, people who know where they live. And they did that because they trusted our government to do the right thing. Do I have that part correct, John?
Yeah, it's about 99% correct. The one part, you know, this was an individual application, so people were not sending additional information about other members. This was, you know, each individual filled out their own application. You didn't have to fill out information about all of your family members. So
okay.
That's not quite accurate. Everything else is accurate. I would take it one step further. You know, when this program was created in 2012, what we really needed from the administration was some assurance that this information would be protected. And
you know where I'm going.
The president issued that. The president issued that under President Obama. He said this will not be used for enforcement. So a written promise, was made. The first 9 months of President Trump's administration, that same promise was made that this information would not be used. People were renewing, you know, all through the campaign and through the first 9 months of the Trump administration with that same promise. So there's some major disappointments, to put it lightly, that will happen if this does turn into enforcement. I do not believe it will, and that's not the point in from my perspective. The point is, you know, the vast majority of Americans support getting this done and getting it done on a permanent basis. We have to light a fire under our elected officials that it is not acceptable to fail these young people.
Well, and these folks, you know, who the government has all the information about, and you know, that is my fear, is that the government will then use that information to start rounding them up. But these folks, John, they represent the best of America. Isn't this, these are hardworking kids who want to succeed, who want to better themselves, their families, and in the end, who want to better this country. I mean, isn't that what we want from our young people?
Absolutely. You know, they're active in every sector of our economy. They're milking cows out in rural Minnesota and working on farms. They're going to college and technical schools. You know, at this moment in the state and across the country, we should be, you know, rolling out the red carpet for anybody who wants to work in our economy. The unemployment rate today, much less when it gets worse as more and more baby boomers retire over the next 20 years, these are American-raised and educated kids who we've invested in for most of their lives, and who are, you know, really well poised to not only fit into our economy, but to help grow our economy. So even if you don't have a humanitarian approach to this, the self-interest for our economic well-being is what is another way to approach it, and a lot of people understand that.
Yep, and there are a lot of folks out in greater Minnesota who are going to need home health care, and there aren't going to be people to provide it. That would be, you know, native-born people to provide it. John, will you do, you've got a minute, but could you let the audience know, what does the Immigrant Law Center do, and if people want to support the Immigrant Law Center, how could they do that? Because you are doing incredible.
Sure,
I want our audience to know you are doing incredible human rights work. So go ahead.
Well, thanks, Ellie. Thanks again for the opportunity to talk about this important issue. And first and foremost, you know, let's get this done. So we really encourage people to reach out to our three Republican representatives. We do have two of them on the record, Eric Paulson, and Emmer have both come out and said they want to do the right thing here. We've yet to hear from Jason Lewis. Contact your representatives. That's where the primary push is going to be. And keep contacting them until we have a solution on it. So please do that. You can get much more information about the DREAM Act, about DACA, on the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota's Facebook page, on our website at ilcm.org. And we absolutely welcome any support that people want to give to help us keep helping these new Americans here in Minnesota.
Well, John, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. You are part of the greater Minnesota legal aid community. It's a community I'm well aware of. And I just want you to know you are on the front lines in many ways. And thank you. I want to just thank you, you and your colleagues at the Immigrant Law Center and Greater Legal Aid. Thank you for protecting humans. It's really critical, you know.
Absolutely. It's some of the most meaningful work in some of the most challenging time right now, and happy to share what we know and invite others to learn more.
Well, John, I've got your back, so take care and be well. We've been speaking with John Keller with the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, talking about DACA and talking about how we can protect our dreamers. Thank you, John. I'll be back after this for the last segment of the show.
This is Kevin Ross from Hoppy Charlie, and you're going to absolutely love our new heated and air-conditioned electric bus. We've completely restored the 1968 West Coaster to its original condition. It's a lightweight electric vehicle so you can taste with no waste. Let us drive you in comfortable style while you have fun tasting beer and learning about the area's best craft breweries and interesting neighborhoods, all without impacting the environment. Book now at 612-607-3681 or online at hoppycharlie.com.
Northeast Minneapolis is known for its creativity, and you'll know exactly why when you eat at Hazel's Northeast. Their creatively prepared comfort food will have you coming back week after week. Breakfasts like biscuits and gravy, granola pancakes, and brisket hash. For lunch, homemade soup and one of the best Reubens in town. And don't miss the daily risotto or Chef Ali's ever-changing dinner specials. Come on in, bring the whole family. Hazel's Northeast delivers real good food. Family-owned at 29th and Johnson in Minneapolis.
Next time on Philosophy Talk, 2017, the examined year.
What happened this past year to challenge our assumptions and make us think about things in new ways?
We'll talk to Larry Kramer, president of the Hewlett Foundation, about the year in democracy and social media.
We'll also talk to Laura Kipnis, author of Unwanted Advances, about the year in gender relations.
It's the examined year, 2017, next time on Philosophy Talk.
Philosophy Talk, every Sunday at 8 a.m. and again at 5 p.m. right here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
What kind of a jackass would let an animal pick their insurance? Did you really think a lizard could save you money on car insurance? Would you let a duck pick your health policy? Insurance can be a zoo, but this is ridiculous. What you really need is an insurance agent that isn't looking out for the insurance companies. You need Cheryl at Array, an independent agent with 30 years experience looking for the best rate possible. Quit monkeying around and call 763-504-3067. That's 763-504-3067 for Cheryl at Array, representing you, not the insurance companies.
Hey Minnesota, Norm Goldman here. The furniture business is one of those industries that's full of fake sales and false discounts. This is the age of the hashtag illegitimate fake president, and haven't you been lied to enough? That's why you need to check out Habitation Furnishing and Design. Habitation offers some of the coolest furniture in Minneapolis at fair prices every day. No fake sales, no phony discounts, just honest, intriguing, and really unique furniture. Check out Habitation on Excelsior Boulevard in St. Louis Park, or visit HabitationDesign.com.
I'm Dr. Vladimir von Surikov, director of the Museum of Russian Art. The museum is currently showing 40 works from the Vladimir School of Painting, which emerged in the 1960s in a town east of Moscow called Vladimir. No doubt you'll be stunned by the colorful and sometimes familiar paintings of this historic and traditional region of Russia. It's well worth the trip to the easiest museum to get to in Minneapolis. Plan your visit today at tmora.org, that is tmora.org.
All right, we're back. Now we're back to the Beatles. Hunter, I love it. We go from banjos to Beatles. You're listening to Ellie Krug. I am filling in for Mike, who is on vacation this week. If you ever so inclined, I do have a regular show on Sundays. It's called Hidden Edges Radio, Sundays from 1 to 2. And starting on the 8th, this Monday, I will begin a half hour show at 7:30 every Monday called Ellie 2.0, about me being this hopeless idealist and some of the things I've encountered in my life as I've been going around the country and into Canada doing training and speaking about human inclusivity. For this last segment, I've got some offbeat as well as some serious, I think would probably be the right word, items to talk about. First, the offbeat. Some of you may have seen this come across your news feed. I had to laugh when I saw it because in Oregon, with the beginning of the first of the new year, the Oregon legislature passed a law, and the law went into effect on January 1st, that Oregonians, for the very first time, have the right to pump their gas. And there was a feed in Huffington Post by David Lohr reporting on how the internet is trolling our Oregonian friends about this new law, because apparently there are some residents of Oregon who aren't happy about having to pump their own gas. Now, bear in mind, there are only, up until January, there were only two states in the country, Oregon and New Jersey, where it was illegal. That's the right word, illegal to pump your own gas. And I'll tell you, I've been to New Jersey before, and the first time I realized that's the way it worked, it was pretty awkward because I was out there getting the gas, putting the gas into the car, and the attendant came out and started yelling at me. I'm like, what's this all about? And so Oregon passed the law. The law went into effect on January 1st. And now all over social media, there are people complaining about such things as, you know, that it's cold and that, you know, they're getting frigid, having to pump gas, or that they're smelling gas fumes, or that there are germs on the pump handle, or that, you know, they're worried about an explosion of some type. And, you know, of course, us Minnesotans, we've been in the midst of a cold spell. I don't know. What was the high today? Probably 4 degrees. The wind chill, I consistently keep hearing the number negative 23. I've been hearing that for the last several days. And so for us here in Minnesota, I think that we would find it funny about the need and all of the trials and tribulations of having to pump your own gas. That's the funny. Now let's get to the probably the more serious and what at least some commentators are saying chilling in describing this story. And that is that multiple news outlets are reporting that Disney World has removed Do Not Disturb signs from 4 hotels connected to the Magic Kingdom in Disney World. The story originally appeared in the Orlando Sentinels, but it's been picked up by multiple news outlets and then expanded. And so, according to those reports, Disneyland, the Disney people, have taken out and removed the Do Not Disturb signs and replaced them with, quote, room occupied, unquote, signs that mean that housekeeping staff will knock on the door every day and that they will intentionally enter the room every day. If for some reason the guests do not want housekeeping or maintenance in their room, they need to make special arrangements on a case-by-case basis with the hotel management. Now, you may be scratching your head. For me, I stay at a number of hotels. I like to make my own bed. I'll hang up the towels. I really don't like people coming into my room, and I certainly don't like the idea that I get a knock on the door when I'm barely dressed. I don't like that stuff. And so I am a habitual do not disturb door hanger. There are questions as to why this policy has come into effect. And it does appear, based on the reports that I've seen, that it has something to do with the October 2017 horrendous shooting incident in Las Vegas where a shooter, barricaded himself essentially in a hotel room without hotel staff ever going into the room. He put a do not disturb sign on the door. Hotel staff didn't go in. And had they gone in, they would have seen an arsenal. I mean, we are talking multiple. I mean, like, I think the reports were 30 different weapons, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And then I believe I read somewhere that there was, you know, like an anti-tank weapon inside the room, things of that nature. And that the gunman evaded detection about this by putting do not disturb on the door. I also read that before this, there are no hotel standards whatsoever about do not disturb signs, about how often the cleaning staff is to go into the room. I mean, there are no rules, no industry standards about it. Apparently, those standards will be created, I would guess, now. And here's the chilling part about this. This is a sign of our times. And we're talking about signs. Here's the pun on that. This is a sign of our times. That we can't even have privacy in our own hotel room now. Room that we're paying for. A room that, you know, we really, you know, don't always want to run around fully dressed. Not that I'm, forget it, I'm not even going there. You know, and it is a sign of the fear that's going on in America right now. I talked a little bit about fear yesterday in a different way. But here we are back to that common idea that we're all afraid. And that we're all afraid of what may happen. And it's not very comfortable. And when we have Disneyland, Disney World, places that are supposed to be filled with happiness and fun and relaxation and getting away from all the stresses of life, when now we have to take precautions against shooters, against mass killers, in those hotels. And soon it will, I guarantee you, this will be a rule within a year from now, will be in all hotels. I mean, again, the question is, what are we coming to? Where will it stop? How far will the fear pervade? What will we do to pull back our lives, to regain this idea that, no, this is all wrong, what we do to each other? Well, that's another show. There you go. Me pontificating again at the end. You will have me for four more shows. The last show next Tuesday will be mainly a call-in show. So you'll get to ask me a bunch of different questions, such as, how do you like sub-hosting? A big thanks to our producer, Hunter Hawks. I will Hawes, and I will be back tomorrow with more. Thank you. This has been Ellie Krug.